Accession number 28355, Reel 19.
I'm sorry, you were saying again about your political masters.
I mean, your comment about the difficulty in getting politicians to focus in on objectives and aims and, you know, relationships with Tonkin. I don't think those certainly arose, but I don't think that should be read across, and I'm not trying to be diplomatic here, I don't think that should be read across as adverse criticism of the individuals involved. It was very new territory for them. To a certain extent, I had the advantage, not only in my service career, but having been involved in the Falklands and realizing, you know, from one's reading of history and so on, that getting your, well, it's good old selection and maintenance of the aim and principles and all that, you know, it's ingrained in you. You don't necessarily think about it in those terms when you're actually saying to a politician, now let's be quite clear what it is you think you're out to achieve. Because it needs to be, that's why I think SOFA discussion is not very satisfactory. When you're making decisions which are going to affect people's lives and livelihood, they need to be recorded so that it is quite clear at the time and subsequently what it was that was intended, and there can't be any misunderstandings there. Now, it was to get that across, and to a certain extent you might say, well, surely politicians have got to make, or members of the cabinet level have got to make decisions about all sorts of other things, can recognise the selection of. But this is a unique area of activity where you're marrying together what you might call political objectives with a military activity and objective as well, which you've got to mesh. I mean, this is no good on its own, nor is this any good on it, this being the military and that being the political, as we're not on television. you know, the two have got to be meshed together. And that was always at the back of my drive. I don't think I initially articulated it to myself, and maybe I am now. It was instinctive rather than I sort of thought down and sat down myself and said, you know, it was instinctive to do it, and then it sort of obviously came out in the notes I wrote about it at the time.
Thank you. Thank you for that. I just have one final question. That is just a small one, really, going back to the appointment of your successor, Dick Vincent. He was vice chief. Is that normal for a CDS to come out at the...
No, it was the first time it's happened. I don't suppose it'll be the last time. But the pure Buggins term, which I think is a very unnecessarily derogatory phrase, because nobody's become a chief of his single service unless he's got some fairly well-recognized qualities. And as I think I've argued before on earlier tapes, you know, it isn't just the individual, it's the team, which the team that supported me and the team that supported Dick Vincent. And Dick Vincent was a good choice.
Who made that choice?
The choice is made by the Secretary of State recommends to the Prime Minister, who recommends the name to the Queen.
Who recommends to the Secretary of State?
It's a discussion. I mean, it'll vary. You know, there isn't a set procedure there.
Were you party to that recommendation?
Yes, I was involved in it.
I detect a little hesitancy in your answers here, possibly.
Well, there's two issues. One was who, and the other was timing. And I think it was time I went, but maybe it was fairly tight from Dick's point of view, because he'd been working at VCDS quite hard. Anyway, that's where it panned out. I leave it at that.
You'll leave it at that, okay. Then I will merely say thank you very much for... This is either our fifth or sixth, I can't remember now. We started, I think, in last October.
Yes, I take total responsibility for stretching your patience and the elastic for
so long. It's been tremendous fun coming up here, and we've had all our discussions in the little House of Lords meeting rooms, and today with Parliament, it's the right word, dissolved or prorogued?
Both. Well, Parliament is prorogued and then dissolved.
And then dissolved.
But dissolution is not a parliamentary procedure, proroguing is.
Right. Well, there's, we haven't actually touched on your time as convener of the House of Lords.
Well.
how did you, when were you ennobled?
I came, well, my pat on the back for the Gulf War was a peerage. Uniquely, Terry Lewin was the only other one who's actually been on a war honours list. So I find myself with a peerage, without knowing very much about this place. I was one stage involved in one of the lottery bids. I chaired one of the companies that bid, one sponsored by GEC, the Tote, and an American company, the EMI, and we didn't win that. Then I got involved here with select committee work on science and technology, where I was initially brought in because they were looking at a military subject. As a co-opted member, and then obviously having sort of approached it in the right way, I don't know what that is, but I was then invited to be a member of the committee, and in due course I chaired a couple of their inquiries, nothing particularly to do with my military background, one was to do with the disposal of oil and gas installations in the North Sea, which is in itself quite a major topic, but you can read all about it in our report if you must. And the other was to do with the use of digital imagery in evidence, in court evidence. And of course, there's no such thing as an original and duplicates of a digital image. They're all unique or the same or can be massaged. And so it was quite interesting on that, I think. Done quite an extensive inquiry on that and sort of led into the use of closed circuit television and the imagery of that and what sort of audit trail you need to have to ensure that if you or I appeared or been a red light jumper, that the number that appears on the print is the number that was actually captured by the digital camera at the time and hasn't been spun.
Remastered.
And I think at one stage I might have even, there was some thought of me chairing the Science and Technology Select Committee, but I think quite rightly it went to somebody else. And then I suppose by this time, this is about 6 or 7 years after I'd sort of come here. I'd been a fairly regular attender on select committee work, but not much to do at the House. And of course, there's no compulsion to attend. You come and go entirely as you wish. And then, Jack, by this time I'd start to share an office downstairs with Jack Weatherall and George Tony Pandey.
Two previous speakers,
and a chap called Jack Simons, who was a law lord, could well have been Lord Chancellor if he hadn't become ill some years ago in the sort of Wilson period. He's still around with it. So, that sort of get me a bit closer, and then Jack became convener. Did it for about 4 or 5 years and then wanted to hand over, and there is an election system, and but they like to do it by just one individual, and there's a sort of by acclamation. So I'd said to Jack, you know, if nobody else will do it, okay, I'll, you know, quite fun. I'd sort of given up any sort of other sort of ties. Then Dick Marsh decided that he would like to do it. So Jack said to me, oh, Dick really ought to be allowed to do it if you don't want to get involved in an election. I thought, well, solve this. The election scheme required 10 or 15 crossbenchers to put your name forward, and then you could run as a candidate. And I had absolutely nothing to do with this. The next thing I was told, you know, that the dozen or 15 names had been put down, and Dick Marsh had drummed up his. And so there wasn't actually an election. And I remember talking to Gareth Williams, who was then leader, lovely man, Williams and Mostyn. He said to me, because he knew that this was going on, he said, have you got your election team together? I said, are you giving me professional political advice or legal advice? I can't afford the latter, and I'm not a politician, so the answer is no, I haven't. Anyway, I got more votes. History doesn't relate how many more than Dick Marsh. So I did it for 2 years, which was the sort of time, and then you could stand for a further 2 years, after which you can't stand.
You do 2 year terms, do you?
Yeah, we have a rotation rule in this house, because otherwise, if you get your toe under, you sit in one chair, you can sit there for life. You're here for life. So there's got to be an all committee, and in the convener's office, too. We go for a rotation rule, so there's 2 years followed by a further two if you and your colleagues are happy about that. So there's, I mean, you could be challenged, but certainly I wasn't challenged. So I did my 4 years, and then, well, 4.5 years, because it took about 6 months of Jack's final period. So that's what I did, and it was a marvellous, well, because you got to know your 180-odd crossbenchers pretty well, and they got to know you.
Do they have a high attendance record? Some
individuals, yes. Other individuals, hardly at all.
Right.
But you got to know most of the 180. Or a few have never turned up, and some you've known from other walks of life. You know, like governors of the Bank of England, or politicians like David Owen, who was a crossbencher, and others. You know, your own military background or diplomatic corps people. But others I'd never come across. And convener is an unusual job. You're not their leader, hence the word convener, because they're all independents, and you can't, by definition, have a leader of independents. But you do act on their behalf in the usual channels, looking after their interests and accommodation and that sort of thing. When there are tributes to deceased members of the House or Queen Mother or whatever, the convener speaks on behalf of, you know, the leaders of the party speak, and then the convener and then the Archbishop. And I always agreed with the Archbishop. You know, when the Queen Mother died, for example, I went to see George Carey. Well, stopped him in the passage and said, George, just because we don't stand up at the same time, would you want to follow the Lib Dems or me? Because you're a Labour, Conservative, Lib Dem. And then it was either him or me. So I said, oh no, you must go first. So we never embarrassed each other by getting up at the same time. You know, it was a great privilege to have him speak like that. Now I find myself, I thought I'd be putting my feet up, but I've been involved very extensively in, well, not understandably, in a new bill, now an act on compensation, pensions and compensation, armed forces pension and compensation bill, which some areas, you know, one's trying to deal with some of the legacy issues. These are individuals who have just missed the cut-off, or war widows, or they've married and been widowed, and then if they marry again, they lose their widow's pension, and things like that. And then more recently, in the charities bill of all things, didn't seem quite my cup of tea, but there are something like 15,000 service non-public funds which have charitable status, and they are known as accepted, accepted charities, which means they don't have to register with the Charity Commission, and by and large they're internal, you know, the beer kitty, officers' mess, funds, scheme clubs, all the 1,001 things, service institute funds. And the new charities bill was doing away with accepted status, and so all these 15,000 charities would be liable, at least initially those with an income of more than 100,000 a year, to register with the Charity Commission. And this, I felt, was quite unnecessary. They don't fundraise from the public. The idea of them being registered is because the public gives them public transparency. They are fully audited within the services, because non-public and non-public funds, for obvious reasons, have got to be kept separate. So there's a perfectly good financial regime which oversees them. There are a number of exempted charities, like university ones, which have their own principal regulator, and I was arguing that we should have similar arrangement within the Ministry of Defence. That bill died, so...
So they're still accepted?
They are still accepted. I took some pleasure in pointing out to the government, who were criticising me for taking this line, weren't prepared to accept it. But the reason that the non-public funds were accepted, because a statutory instrument was signed in 1965 accepting them from both registering with the Charity Commission and submitting accounts, accepted them from doing, you know, excused them from doing that. And it was signed by Frank Soskis, Home Secretary. Yeah. So, you know, I find, I guess the reason I was up here this morning was on this Gulf War illness. And I was making a pitch there. I've spoken two or three times in the House on the subject. Alf Morris is the great mover and shaker with the Royal British Legion on it. So, you know, from time to time I'm still getting involved. I'm enjoying it. I mean, it's a great privilege to be here. Marvellous people to be working with. I mean, the crossbenchers are, you know, from the top drawer of many of the great and the good.
Yes.
And it's, you know, to be on regular meeting and obviously Christian name terms with them, it's great fun. A nice retirement activity, and it's time we packed up. Thank you very much.
It is time we packed up. I'm just going to ask you this one last question before we finish, and that is that you said that you were ennobled because it was a thank you for your Gulf War guidance and handling of it. Peter Hill Norton told me, so it's from that source, that he was one of those people who lobbied to ensure that all CDSs became members of the House of Lords.
Ah, yeah, that's a different issue. Yes, and that's been accepted, by and large, because you're now into a different regime, a different... Terry Lewin and I fought wars. There were honours and awards lists, you know, DFCs, MCs, and all the rest of it. And the head of both those lists was Terry Lewin, for the Falklands and myself for this one. Mike Boyce came in, he's got a peerage, but he didn't come in on a Gulf II war list. I don't read anything into that. But you've got to go back to what the government, this government, did with the honours and awards and peerages. When the Prime Minister came in, he said he disliked having to nominate for the New Year and Birthday Honours list peerages, individuals for peerages, and there should be an appointments commission. And by the way, we'll get rid of the hereditaries and so on. So an independent appointments commission, Dennis Stevenson's thing, was set up, the people's peers. And the fix was that Dennis would find individuals, the Prime Minister would say how many he had to find, and he, the Prime Minister, would then put those names forward without further change to the Queen for her approval. And that's where the people's peers come in. Now, those individuals expected to be parliamentarians, just as working peers, those are peerages, are awarded to party political individuals. And we lost the peer honour, this New Year and Birthday Honours list. And we have nothing which says that somebody like me in Gulf War 3 or 4 would get a peerage as an honour without any obligation to be a parliamentarian. And there are a few individuals, Charles Guthrie, for example, when he retired, the Dennis Stevenson lot had just more or less started, done their first lot, and it was suggested to Charles he should apply to Dennis Stevenson, which was outrageous. So the Prime Minister accepted that exceptionally he would nominate the Governor of the Bank of England, the head of the Home Civil Service, CDS, archbishops. And the latest proposal now on revision is that the Prime Minister said that he will nominate in any parliament 10 individuals, or around 10 individuals, without them having to go through the Independent Appointments Commission. So we're almost back
to where we were. You were.
And I've argued, it seems to me, it was perfectly respectable for the Prime Minister of the day to be given, yes, by all means, given an Appointments Commission to help him sift individuals and so on, but I don't see why he should shirk the responsibility. Which goes with the office.
Yes.
So it's rather interesting how the wheel has started to turn. But there's still some confusion now as to whether a peerage is an honour or not, which I think is a great pity, because I think it should be looked upon, regardless of whether you come in. But if you're going to just look upon it as, you know, something which comes up with the rations, you know, it's not an honour, then I think that debases it for those that have been honoured,
yes,
or were honoured in the past, because there's a lot of people here who came in on New Year and Birthday honours lists, or dissolution honours lists, or resignation honours lists. Are they honours now? And I went to see Charlie Faulkner point out that, you know, as far as a future winner of a war, you know, might have a Third World War, you want to honour people, as we did in World War II. What's happened to that? It's a mess.
Yep.
Right, time to go, I must go.
Right, well, it just remains for me to say thank you very much indeed for this tremendous contribution.
Well, I'm not sure about that, but thank you very much.